Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood. According to a directive from the Department of Best Practices, two guests today. Brooke Harrington will talk about offshore wealth, and Manhendran Turnvarangan will talk about the new leftist government in Sri Lanka. Most of us are aware of the fact that vast pots of money are stashed in tax shelters around the world. How does that all work? Who are the money stashers, and who are the technicians that make their secrecy possible? Here with some answers to those questions is Brooke Harrington, a professor of sociology at Dartmouth. She was on this show in November 2017, just after the release of the Paradise Papers, a set of electronic documents that were leaked from a law firm called Appleby, which specializes in offshoring money. Appleby has offices in all the major sites, like Bermuda, the British Virgin Islands, Jersey, and Mauritius. Among those listed in the papers as having offshore accounts were Queen Elizabeth and her son Charles, many foreign political figures, including three former Canadian prime ministers, several members of the first Trump administration, Madonna, George Soros, Jeffrey Epstein, and Bono. Numerous brand-name corporations are also revealed as tax dodgers in the documents. That release came a year and a half after the release of the Panama Papers, a similar set of electronic documents. And then in 2021 came the Pandora Papers, sourced from a number of operators in the offshore industry, which revealed offshore holdings of 35 political figures from around the world and 100 business people and celebrities. Despite the rich detail and all the names named, there was remarkably little political fallout from the revelations. Brooke Harrington's previous book, Capital Without Borders, was published in 2016. Now she's out with a short, highly readable look at this world, Offshore, Stealth Wealth and the New Colonialism, published by Norton. Not only is she a sociologist, she completed training to get certified as a wealth manager, the people who handle the details of hiding money. She never practiced the trade, she did it to get an entree into that world. Not just anyone can talk to these highly paid technicians. With the credentials, she could enter their world far more effectively. Brooke Harrington.
Before I get into the interesting policy stuff, engage in a little of what we in the trade call service journalism. Say I have a few score million I got from shady activities or I want to hide it from the tax man. How would I go about this? Before you answer that question, what is the price of admission exactly? How much do I need to be a credible money hider?
I don't think many wealth managers would really take on a client who had less than about $5 million in investable assets. And even that would be a borderline case. And for most Americans, your net worth is very heavily influenced by whether you own a home and the value of that home. But when wealth managers talk about investable assets, they're talking about your net worth minus the value of your home, because that's not a liquid asset that you could be moving around offshore. Most people don't meet that $5 million rock bottom threshold of investable assets. And even if you could sort of get over the hump with that amount, you'd be sharing your wealth manager with maybe a dozen or two other clients. If you really want the bespoke high-touch service, you're probably looking more at like triple that amount and upwards. When you start getting into $50 million or more, then you can have not just a whole wealth manager to yourself, but you might be able to have what's called a family office, where you have an entire team of advisors working for you. A wealth manager, maybe a philanthropy advisor, maybe a specialized accountant and tax advisor, et cetera, et cetera. Rockefellers and Bloombergs have that sort of family office arrangement.
Okay, and so if I have this money I want to hide, how do I go about it?
First, you get yourself a wealth manager, because if you're genuinely a wealthy person, if you're new money, you're probably pretty busy continuing to earn the wealth. And if you're old money, you're probably off on your yacht or in St. Bart's somewhere. And the last thing you want to do is bone up on the tax code of the Cayman Islands. So you need to hire a specialist who will keep abreast of the latest legal developments in a variety of important offshore centers. And then you outsource your wealth to them. If you have considerable wealth, you find service personnel through word of mouth, the way that you might find a nanny for your children or a hairdresser. Because the number one thing you're going to be concerned about is discretion and secrecy. And when you're really rich, that discretion is essential. A serious hazard of wealth is that wealth attracts all kinds of con artists and third cousins once removed who come out of the woodwork and they want a piece of what you've got. Likely, you're going to either find other rich people or get yourself introduced to other rich people, and then you have some discreet conversations with them about who's good, who can be relied upon as a wealth manager. And then probably you go interview a couple of them, and you have strategy meetings. Like, here's what I want to accomplish. They'll ask you, what do you want to accomplish? Do you have children? Do you want to disinherit? Do you have a secret family? Famously, in the offshore world, they say the median client is a man in his 50s who is married with children, but also has at least one mistress on the side who may also have children. And so part of the wealth manager's job is providing for these secret families and making sure that the wife doesn't know about the mistress and the mistresses don't know about each other, and keeping everyone happy and keeping them from suing to get their chunk of the client's wealth. Because once lawsuits start happening, then records become public and the game is up.
Gosh, life is so complicated when you're rich.
More money, more problems, as they say.
Yes. So let's talk a bit about the geography of these offshore havens. There are curiously an awful lot of former British colonies that are prominent in this. Why this prominence of former British colonies?
There are two reasons for that. Of course, lots of countries have vast empires. The Spanish had vast and wealthy empires, but none of their former colonies have become offshore financial centers. The French, same thing. Mauritius was for a time French, but even it was closer in history a British colony. The British brought two things with them to all of their colonies, two things that are essential to the creation of offshore financial centers. One is their whole strategy for getting native Brits to go out and colonize these places was to give them tax breaks. So there was this expectation on these usually island or subcontinental territories that if you went out to be an expat colonist, you would pay either no taxes or very, very low taxes. So that set up this sort of institutional history of tax relief. The Spanish, in contrast, taxed their colonists more than the people back home in Spain. That's one historical reason you don't see any former Spanish colonies becoming tax havens. Secondly, the British brought the common law to all of their former colonies. And the common law has built into its operating system a series of tricks that you can play with ownership that allow you to conceal who really owns what. And when you conceal who really owns what, it becomes very difficult to tax an asset or to tax a person. The main trick is what's called the trust. A trust, as in a trust fund, enables you to divide the ownership of an asset into two pieces. One piece is the legal ownership. That means responsibility for the asset, like to pay taxes on it if it's taxed, or to be liable for it in case the asset hurts somebody. Say it's an oil tanker. If your oil tanker springs a leak and spills millions of gallons of oil into the Gulf of Mexico, if that oil tanker is owned by a trust and you're the trustee, well then, unfortunately, you, Doug Henwood, are on the hook to deal with that. But if I get all the profits from that oil tanker, if I'm what's called the beneficial owner of the trust that owns the tanker, then I'm not liable in any way.
That's very ingenious.
It is. It's an idea that actually came from the Middle Ages. In Britain, it used to be that the only real form of wealth was land, and the only time land or wealth got taxed was when the owner died. So the British nobles, just like the nobility of today, don't like to pay their taxes. And they figured, well, what if the owner of my property never actually died? Then no tax would be due. How can I make that happen? They figured out that if they could just sign over the title to their estates to a trusted friend, like a cousin or a neighbor, and say, okay, now you're the owner. And if they pick someone who is considerably younger, that it was a pretty sure thing that no tax would ever be assessed on their estate. Now, of course, you have to trust someone when you hand them the title to your property. And so these trusts weren't given to everyone. And when you agreed to be someone's trustee, it wasn't a contract. It's still not like a civil contract. In the Middle Ages, the way that a trust was made was you swore an oath to God. And if you violated that oath, the descendants of the person who gave you the title to the land could take you to court, but it wasn't a civil court. It was an ecclesiastical court. In other words, a religious court in which the judges were bishops. And if you were found to have violated the trust that was placed in you to hold on to this land title for the benefit of my descendants, then you weren't just convicted by the bishops. You were excommunicated from the church and cursed to eternal damnation. That idea has somehow survived into the 21st century, this idea of divided ownership, which is the foundation of trusts and of the British common law. And now it's the lifeblood, not only of rich individuals hiding their wealth offshore, but it's the lifeblood of corporate finance. Any of your listeners who has a pension, for example, any of your listeners who owns any corporate bonds, pension funds and corporate bonds are all built on the concept of the trust.
Some U.S. states are rivaling the tiny islands that few people could point to on a map. What's happening there?
Any place in the world can become an offshore financial center. The United States is one of the world's leading financial centers. We can't take advantage of it because we're U.S. citizens. But anyone who isn't a U.S. citizen is very glad to use the U.S. because we have some of the lightest regulation in the world. Even as the Biden administration was trying to sanction Russian oligarchs, individual U.S. states were undercutting that federal sanctions policy by helping Russian oligarchs use their states as offshore financial centers to stash money and especially to buy real estate. New York and Florida were among the top offenders there. Delaware, of course, is famous as a corporate tax haven, but for individual rich people, the states of Wyoming and South Dakota and Nevada are very popular as ways to stash money out of sight and out of reach of your home country's tax authorities and courts.
I would imagine that rich people would find the U.S. a more secure place to keep their money than some small island in the middle of nowhere.
In some respects, yes, although with what the Trump administration is planning to do to the U.S. dollar and the U.S. legal system, I'm not sure that will be the case going forward. To speak up for the little islands in the middle of nowhere, there are places that are real cowboy jurisdictions, you might call them, places that are blacklisted by the rest of the global financial system because they're known to do a lot of dirty dealing. Other islands that are still under the dominion of the United Kingdom, like the Caymans, for example, are also considered very safe and secure because they're sort of under the umbrella of the UK, but not subject to UK tax laws. So they're partly independent and partly not independent. You can hide a lot of wealth in the Caymans and the British Virgin Islands, but if anything goes wrong, you have the security of knowing that your final court of appeal is actually in London.
Now, what about Trump? You mentioned him. I'm divided between thinking he'll cut taxes for the rich so much that it won't be so important to hide your money and thinking he'll just let the whole sheltering operation rip. What do you think is going to happen?
To kind of zoom back from that question a little bit, I think the ultra rich in this country have largely solved the problem of not paying taxes. Oligarchs of old really had this two-pronged agenda, reducing taxation on themselves and reducing regulation on themselves. Here we are in the 21st century after a bunch of Republican administrations, and I think that dragon has been slain. ProPublica did some investigative reporting on the tax rates of people like Elon Musk and Jeff Bezos and found that the pair of them go entire years paying zero in income tax. And when they do pay tax, it ends up being in the neighborhood of 1 to 3.5%. Instead of the top marginal rate, which is by statute about, I think, 39.6%. They've effectively brought their tax rates down to zero already. So what's next for them? Right now, their big push seems to be to either supplant the U.S. dollar with crypto or to make crypto a peer of the U.S. dollar. J.D. Vance was installed, basically, by people who've gone all in on crypto. And as of yesterday, the incoming administration is thinking of appointing a specialized crypto czar and appointing Lutnick, a big crypto proponent, as secretary, I think it's Secretary of Commerce or Treasury.
Yeah, it's Commerce.
Starting in around July, when Trump, who used to be very anti-crypto and called it a scam, starting in July, Trump began giving keynote speeches at crypto conferences and saying, I am the crypto president. That is the next big play for American oligarchs. That worries me a lot because it's extremely destabilizing, not just for the U.S. economy, but for the world economy, which uses the U.S. dollar as its reserve currency and has done since the Bretton Woods Agreement of 80 years ago. What happens if you take that pillar of the world economy away? You definitely weaken American economic and political power worldwide. But like all of us who have our life savings denominated in U.S. dollars, what do we do when crypto becomes a competitor or a replacement for the dollar? Because it's a zero-sum game between the two of them. You can't have a strong dollar and strong Bitcoin or whatever the version of crypto is going to be. It's going to be one or the other. And right now, the Trump administration is pressing for crypto. If it goes that direction, it may moot a lot of these issues about using the offshore system, because then crypto provides secrecy that a lot of wealthy people and drug dealers and arms dealers like.
I'm speaking with the sociologist Brooke Harrington, author of Offshore, Stealth Wealth and the New Colonialism, published by Norton. What is the cost of this? How much revenue is lost to the tax system because of all this scheming?
Economists like Gabriel Zucman at the University of California at Berkeley and Annette Alstadsdatter at the University of Life Sciences in Norway, they've made very complex and interesting calculations about this. It's difficult to estimate exactly because what's held offshore is shrouded in secrecy. That's part of what protects the system. But we have piecemeal data from things like the Panama Papers and the Paradise Papers and the Pandora Papers, which were big leaks of this secret data from offshore. And from that, they can make some educated guesses about what is really costing the world to have apparently all the world's billionaires and most of the world's multinational firms using the offshore system. The estimates are that it costs world governments about $500 billion annually in unpaid corporate taxes and about $200 billion annually in unpaid individual taxes from wealthy individuals. So roughly $700 billion unpaid taxes a year to governments of the world. And that's a lot of hospitals that don't get built and a lot of schools and roads that don't get maintained, a lot of public goods that just are allowed to rot or that never get created in the first place.
It seems like we're all under constant surveillance, so one wonders how hard it would be to track down these characters. Is the problem technical or is it really a political issue?
It's a combination of both. One of the first things people pay for when they get rich is privacy. Gated communities or living on their super yachts or flitting around on their private jets, owning multiple passports. And this is a problem not just for governments, but for other rich people, because it turns out that rich people not only enjoy avoiding their taxes, but they don't like to pay back their debts either. And so there's a whole cottage industry now in being bounty hunters for rich deadbeats who don't want to pay back money that they've borrowed from other rich people. And those bounty hunters have the same problems that the U.S. government or the government of Germany or the government of South Africa have, which is, how do you find people who have purchased almost impenetrable secrecy? It's very common, for example, for the ultra-rich to pay full-time staff simply to keep their names out of the papers. It's an extension of the problem that many of your listeners may have heard about that happens to lottery winners. You may have noticed that it's increasingly common to see people showing up to accept lottery winnings in disguise with like a Halloween mask on. And the reason people do that is because whenever someone knows that you've come into a bunch of money, it attracts legions of hangers-on and charlatans and people who want a piece of what you have. So it's imperative to keep secret your identity. And this problem haunts rich people everywhere. And if they're rich enough, they can afford to insulate themselves from the surveillance that many of us are subject to. In fact, one of the measures you could make of inequality is precisely that the poorer you are, the more surveilled you are. Like, think of what you have to do to qualify for food benefits or unemployment benefits. You really have to drop trowel, as we used to say in the 80s. But if you're rich, you can own a company that isn't publicly traded. You could be a very wealthy person and never show up on one of those richest 400 people in the world lists, because those lists are only composed of people for whom there is publicly available data. If you just own a family-owned company that's closely held, you don't have to worry about that. So it's also a political problem. What I just described is the technical problem. The political problem is, as the offshore leaks like the Panama Paradise and Pandora Papers have shown us, the politicians who are empowered to shut a lot of this down are themselves beneficiaries of the offshore financial system. Depressingly, ever since 2016, we've seen this rogues gallery of heads of state, corporate leaders, celebrities go by, some of whom we only know about because they present themselves to the world as anti-corruption figures. First, it was David Cameron, who was the Prime Minister of the United Kingdom and who had developed a bit of a reputation for wagging his finger of disapproval at boy bands who incorporated in Ireland to avoid UK taxes. Come to find out in the Panama Papers that he himself was the beneficiary of an offshore trust. And then fast forward 5 years to the Pandora Papers, and it turns out that heads of state like Babiš in Czechia and Uhuru Kenyatta in Kenya, who had come into office as anti-corruption campaigners, were themselves using multiple offshore structures in order to dodge taxes, money launder, and do all kinds of incredibly corrupt things that enabled them to get and stay rich and enrich their whole families. It's just a depressing Groundhog Day type story where it's like, oh yeah, that again. That's the unfortunate reason that we don't see more action on this, is that the politicians themselves are often among the most compromised people when it comes to the offshore system.
I'm struck by the moral code of today's rich. I don't want to get carried away with idealizing the past, but, you know, Rockefeller built cathedrals and universities, and Carnegie built libraries, and Bezos shoots himself into space. Quinn Slobodian has a newish book about all those special zones that plutocrats are building for themselves, exempt from taxes and regulations, like they're looking to secede from society generally. How does this fit in with the world you've been studying?
Yeah, I think Quinn is absolutely right about this. And the offshore system is the creation and the instrument of people who have figured out that they're richer and more powerful than the government of any particular nation state. So what they can do is just ignore the nation state or build their own. And so people like Peter Thiel and Marc Andreessen invest heavily in projects like creating Bitcoin cities and seasteading, where they're literally trying to build islands near Tahiti that they will turn into these libertarian anarchist utopias where not only do you have no tax, but you have no democracy. Citizenship is a private contract with corporate rule. This is part and parcel of the belief of many of the new billionaires, the tech oligarchy, who have been quite public with their belief that they are almost a superior race entitled to rule the rest of us. Hence their concern with putting women back in the home and making them have babies. White babies, of course. White babies with intelligent men just like them.
It's striking how many of these guys are products of apartheid-era South Africa.
Yeah. They've basically taken that idea and run with it. Many of them are also people who were deeply influenced by their own accounts by science fiction, fantasy, and comic books. Thiel talks about this a lot, the importance of fantasy in shaping his ideas about what a better world would look like. Musk has also been very open about this. Those fantasy stories, those comic book stories, are almost all about heroic individual men who are born special and they save the world. There's really no room for democracy in that. There's no room for other people, for that matter, except to serve them and their greatness.
It's like money is not just the means for leading a very comfortable life. It's a means for lording it over everyone else.
Yeah, and to get back to your earlier question about why are these folks so different from the Rockefellers and the Carnegies, the Rockefellers and the Carnegies, nowadays, we would call them part of the old rich, the old money ethos. That's a very old set of values that says wealth must justify itself. The Medici were trying to do the same thing in the Middle Ages. They basically bought the Renaissance as a massive exercise in reputation laundering because they were constantly being accused of mortal sins like usury. They were the Pope's bankers. They became fabulously rich, and so they were always subject to what were then extremely serious accusations of lending money at interest or borrowing money at interest. To keep the population and the critics at bay, they were like, oh, we only make money in order to benefit the glory of God and the people of Florence. And so they bankrolled Botticelli and the building of the Duomo in Florence. And lucky us, now we can enjoy these great works of Renaissance art. You can draw a straight line from the Medici to people like Carnegie and Rockefeller, who came from a Protestant tradition, but they still were immersed in this old world view that there's something a little suspect about wealth, and it's constantly under pressure to justify itself morally. Hence the Carnegie libraries and the universities from Carnegie and Rockefeller. But with new money, the value system has been inverted. Any sort of philanthropy looks like it's just for chumps. Even paying your fair share of taxes looks like it's just for chumps. Wealth needs no moral justification. It only needs to be conspicuously consumed.
You know, we've had the 3P papers. We had the ProPublica stuff you mentioned, where they released the tax returns of very rich people, showing they paid little or no taxes. Yet this has really not had much of a political impact. People just kind of yawn and just say, I don't know, you can't fight City Hall, you can't fight Elon Musk, or I don't know what, but there's a resignation or a lack of outrage over stuff that looks like it should be outrage-inducing.
Yes, I agree. And I think there are two reasons for that. One is people become apathetic when they see this Groundhog Day-like repetition of the rich getting away with it. The Panama Papers, Paradise, and Pandora Papers have all been anticlimactic. Very few prosecutions have ensued, despite the massive release of data that would seem pretty incriminating. And that's because it turns out that a lot of what happens offshore, even though it seems like it ought to be illegal, is not in fact illegal. By my count, there have been less than a dozen criminal convictions as a result of those 7 terabytes of data that were released in those 3 leaks. While people might find the behaviors of people who use the offshore system morally reprehensible, in many cases, it's at least in a legal gray area that would take maybe a decade of very expensive litigation to sort out. And most governments find that politically unpalatable. It's risky to undertake those sort of prosecutions. You're taking on the richest and most powerful people in a society, and your chances of winning are far from assured. So they just don't bother. People see that happening over and over again, and they're like, okay, well, I guess this is our new normal. We have to live with being ripped off by the rich. Then there's another group of people who are probably in the majority who don't even know what offshore finance is. They've never heard of the 3 P's. They're just unaware that this massive ripoff is happening. Thomas Piketty, the French economist, writes about this. He says, a lot of people realize that there's a massive disconnect between their vote and their interests on the one hand and what the politicians in their countries actually do. But they don't know why. They don't know that in many cases, the ultra-rich have bought the political system. And that's why it's not functioning the way a democracy is supposed to function.
It's amazing that we're seeing this guy who takes pride in paying no taxes returning to the White House as an example of some kind of populist rebellion. It's a very strange distortion of political language.
Well, yeah, that's Piketty's point. He says it's really easy to sell populism to people who don't know what's hit them. They know that something has hit them, but they're kind of dazed, and they can't see these ultra-rich people who are hidden behind multiple walls of secrecy and doing a lot of their business offshore. So it's easy to say, you know why you're dazed? You have been hit by something bad, and it's those immigrants over there, or those gay people, or those transgender people. It's their fault. You should be mad at them.
Should we have some kind of political transformation or awakening and want to get control over this stuff? It does seem like the wealth managers are the vulnerable point. They are the technicians of this trade. They make it possible. There aren't that many of them. Could they somehow be key to shutting it down or reining it in?
Yes. None of the offshore system could work without these sort of technical experts, the wealth managers. Because as I mentioned before, wealthy people themselves don't manage their own money. They're either too busy making it or enjoying it. And when you have wealth on a global scale, you really need a team of people to keep up with legal developments that affect your money and to protect you from people who want a piece of what you've got. One of the things I've been doing recently as an outgrowth of these, 17 years of qualitative research I've been doing on the offshore financial system and the ultra-rich, is I've been working with some colleagues here at Dartmouth, Dan Rockmore in computer science and Herbert Chang in the quantitative social science department. And they do network research with big data. We've been taking some ideas from my qualitative research and testing it with these gigantic piles of offshore data that came out in the leaks of the past 8 years. And what we found is that we can actually show quantitatively that if you disrupt the wealth managers, you basically shut down billionaires' access to their offshore wealth. But that's the most efficient way of disrupting the offshore financial system, is you don't really sanction the oligarchs themselves, who are the beneficiary of the system. You sanction the people who make the system work, because they're the only ones who understand how it works.
And finally, at the end of the book, you talk about the power of stigma to wrestle these people to the ground. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, and this is, I think, a unique contribution of a sociological perspective on the ultra-rich. The level of wealth inequality we have in the world is so disastrous and dangerous for things like democracy and even for capitalism that you can't just understand it from the lens of one discipline. So we need economists, we need anthropologists, we need political scientists and geographers, as well as sociologists, all in on the game. But one of the things that sociology has a unique angle on is the dynamics of interpersonal status. I would imagine many of your listeners would think, as I used to think, well, if I ever became a billionaire, I would simply cease to care about what most people thought of me. Like, the whole point of insulating yourself with wealth would seem to be that you don't have to care what other people think. But to my great surprise, a consistent theme I've heard year after year after year in interviews and also seen in the news is that billionaires and oligarchs care every bit as much as your average sixth grader about their reputation and what other people are saying about them. But what really differentiates the ultra-rich is their ability to prosecute and punish people who speak ill of them. They're very good at doing it, say, to journalists, to shut down journalists from uncovering embarrassing facts about them. But as we've seen with people like Elon Musk, or after the Russian invasion of Ukraine in 2022, with people like Vladimir Putin, the richest people in the world become incensed if there's any hint of social stigma applied to them. So just to give you an example, after the 2022 invasion of Ukraine started in February, it took several months before Putin actually got on camera to push back against all the sanctions that were being leveled against him and his associates and against his country. And they were pretty crushing sanctions. Cutting Russia off from the international financial system is a big, big deal. That didn't get him in front of a camera, though. What finally got him in front of a camera was the EU merely discussing the possibility of refusing to issue tourist visas to the tiny number of Russian elites who have a passport for foreign travel, shutting out Russian elites from going skiing in Courchevel or swanning around the Mediterranean on their luxury yachts. That was the bridge too far that got Putin out in front of a camera, condemning cancel culture and talking about how nukes were going to be rained down on the EU if they implemented this idea. And I thought that was really telling, because all across the spectrum of Russian oligarch, what's really gotten them incensed is not the hit to their pocketbook or ways that they've been cut off technically, say, from obtaining replacement parts for airplanes or yachts. What really gets them is being stigmatized for being Russian. In addition to the surprise of that, that suggests a real point of leverage, that simply being refused access to polite society, however the oligarchs define polite society, remains one of the very last resorts society has to protect itself against predators on this scale.
That was Brooke Harrington, professor of sociology at Dartmouth and author of Offshore, published by Norton. My name is Doug Henwer, and the program is Behind the News. Back after a musical break.
Offshore banking business, international crime, offshore banking.
That was some of Offshore Banking Business, the 1979 song by the members. Next, an election in Sri Lanka. A couple of weeks ago, I was struck by some headlines reporting that the country had just installed a new Marxist-leaning government, as an AP headline put it. My curiosity was piqued. The truth, as we'll hear, is somewhat less dramatic. In September, Anura Kumara Dissanayake, apologies for brutalizing the pronunciation there, was elected president. And then in mid-November, a collection of parties led by him, called the National People's Power, won an overwhelming victory in parliamentary elections. No, this island country of 22 million off the southern tip of India is not the vanguard of global revolution. But interesting things have been happening there. Here to talk about them is Manhendran Tervarangan, and further pronunciation apologies there, a lecturer in English at the University of Jaffna. Manhendran Tervarangan. AKD won election as president in September, and then his party just scored a decisive victory in parliamentary elections a couple of weeks ago, far more decisive than a presidential vote. First of all, who is he? I've seen him described as Marxist-leaning. What, if anything, does that mean, and what are his politics?
He has been part of a political party called the Janata Vimukti Peramuna, which participated or staged two insurrections against the Sri Lankan state. The first one was in the early 1970s, and the second one was during the latter part of the 1980s, and both insurrections were brutally crushed by the Sri Lankan state. And afterwards, his party became a mainstream political party and contested elections thereafter. The Janata Vimukti Peramuna was part of an alliance that formed a government in Colombo, and Mr. Anura Kumara Dissanayake and many of his party members who got elected to parliament became ministers, but they served as ministers briefly, and then due to some disagreement with their alliance partner, the JVP quit the government and thereafter sat on the opposition benches. And during the last elections, both in the presidential and parliamentary elections, they performed spectacularly, and now they have formed the government. So AKD has been the leader of the JVP for the past 12 years or so. And yeah, the Janata Vimukti Peramuna was originally a very strong Marxist party, but I think the party then moved further towards a center kind of political position. So it is now known as a center-left party or a left-leaning party. That's how we in Sri Lanka see this party. And the party wasn't elected on its own. It formed a broader coalition called the National People's Power, which included different trade unions and some left parties and civil society groups. It's an alliance that won these two elections. You cannot consider this as a radical Marxist party or a revolutionary communist party. It's very different from that brand of left politics. This is a center-left or left-leaning political formation. That's how I would describe this political alliance.
He won a lot of the Tamil territory. That is rather significant. What does that mean, and why did they win that?
Generally, if you look at the electoral history of Sri Lanka, Tamil nationalist parties have electorally, they have done so well in the northern part of the country because they either demanded a separate state, let's say in the 1970s, but later on, or even earlier, and then later, at present, they demand a federal form of government so that not all the powers are concentrated in Colombo, but some of these powers are devolved to the regions, especially the northern and eastern provinces, where the Tamils and Muslim people who also speak Tamil form the majority population. But this time what happened was there was fragmentation within the Tamil nationalist camp. So there were five different groups fighting elections in the name of Tamil nationalism. So the votes got split among these parties. So none of them could become powerful or strong in electoral terms. That's number one. But there are also other reasons. One is the National People's Power Alliance, led by President AKD, positioned itself as an inclusive and non-discriminatory, non-racist force. So compared to the mainstream political parties in Sri Lanka, such as the United National Party or the Sri Lanka Freedom Party or Sri Lanka Podujana Peramuna, this party positioned itself in more inclusive terms, and as a result, there was a shift away from Tamil nationalist politics, and some people who generally vote for Tamil nationalist parties this time voted for the National People's Power. And then there is also the Tamil voters are generally disgruntled with their elected MPs who represented them in parliament last time because they couldn't deliver anything politically or economically. And there is also the country is going through a huge economic crisis, and there are Tamil-speaking people in rural areas who were affected by the war or who have faced historical caste oppression, and because of the economic crisis, their livelihoods are facing threats, and there are lack of employment opportunities, there is increasing poverty. Because of all these reasons, people thought voting for a candidate or a political formation that promises to bring some economic relief was important. And that is one of the reasons why AKD was popular in the North. But he was also popular in the South for similar reasons. But what makes his popularity in the North very special this time is because I think he positioned himself as a non-discriminatory, inclusive kind of political formation.
Sri Lanka is one of those countries with both a president and a prime minister, kind of like France or Israel. What's the division of powers between those two offices? And what about the person he appointed as prime minister, Harini Amarasuri?
Yes. Our political system is known as the executive presidential system. So the president has a lot of powers, and the president is directly elected by the people of the country. The prime minister doesn't have any specific responsibilities as prime minister, but the prime minister is sometimes a very ceremonial kind of figure, but sometimes what happens is the prime minister becomes a member of the cabinet with a certain portfolio. So if you look at Harini Amarasuriya's position in this cabinet, she is also the Minister of Education, Higher Education. So she has certain responsibilities in the area of education. I don't know much about what role she will be playing as Prime Minister, but she has specific responsibilities as Minister of Education. And as Prime Minister, maybe she will be leading the ruling party in parliament, for instance, and she will be a very important dignitary, probably when leaders from abroad come to Sri Lanka, she will participate in bilateral discussions, and she may probably go abroad and represent the country. But president will also do these things, but there will be certain instances where the prime minister will also do some of these tasks. I am more interested in seeing what role she is going to play as the Minister of Education, because she has been an activist for free education for a long time, and she has worked for a long time on educational reforms in the country. So that is an area where she may be able to bring about some radical changes. That is something that I'm waiting to see.
The background to all this is a severe economic crisis, which the country has been troubled by for several years. What caused the crisis, and how does this government think it can get out of it?
One of the major reasons for the crisis is our spending. Our imports were very expensive, and in a way, the balance, there was a balance of payment issue. The previous regimes also borrowed a lot of money from international bond markets at very high interest rates, and they defaulted in 2022. Those are some of the immediate reasons. But we have been a very import-oriented economy and didn't really invest in developing an export sector, manufacturing sector. So because of all those reasons, our foreign exchange was always going out. And we relied mostly on remittances sent by women workers in the Middle East or women who work in garment factories. So because of our economic policies were very much dependent on imports, I think that is the major reason for the current economic crisis. In order to get out of that, the previous government started to negotiate with the IMF, and then the IMF introduced a package with certain conditions. But that IMF agreement has in fact added to the burdens of the people, because they were pushing the government more in the direction of market economic policies. And as a result, subsidies for fuel and electricity were slashed, and there is less spending on education and health. The transport costs have increased, electricity costs have increased, cost of living has gone up. So because of all those reasons, we seem to be still in a very severe crisis. And this crisis has become worse for the poor segments of society, for the working people, those who have faced historical caste-based oppression. The solutions don't seem to be working.
An IMF program has never been known as the route to prosperity.
Yes. So what the government have to do maybe to introduce wealth tax, and they have to increase their revenue by way of introducing new forms of taxation maybe, and they have to also introduce, build a robust economy where the country can produce more, and then what the country gains by building its economy, the gains should reach all levels of society. Sometimes what happens is it's like, you know, all these policies only benefit the rich. The rich becomes richer and the poor become poorer. So we have a different kind of economic thinking, I think, that is necessary, because the neoliberal policies that Sri Lankan governments have followed since 1977 have not worked.
Does the new government have an agenda, a plan, and the political power to carry through with some kind of departure from the norm?
Initially, they said that they would renegotiate with the International Monetary Fund and urge them to relax some of the conditions that they laid down so that they will be able to spend more on social welfare programs. But now it appears that they will most probably follow the line taken by the previous regime, at least in the short run, and probably the austerity measures. Maybe there may be some little changes in the austerity measures introduced after the IMF agreement. But in general, I don't see a big shift in the way this new government is going to handle the economy.
Let's talk some about the class structure. The country has been described as an oligarchy. Just a couple of families have been ruling it for a couple of decades. Could you talk about that structure?
Yes. For the most part of our post-independence history, there were like two important parties, the United National Party and the Sri Lankan Freedom Party, that alternatively ruled the country. But again, within these two parties, certain families dominated, the Sena Nayakas, then the Jayawardhanas, then the Bandaranaikas, then the Rajapakshas, and their children, and like, you know, it was kind of a very dynastic kind of political system that we have had for a long time. People are now disillusioned with these families, and they also see that these families have also looted the wealth of the country and, like, you know, didn't really do anything to uplift the communities or bring any kind of economic prosperity. So they have amassed power for themselves, but didn't really do anything for the larger community. And that is one of the reasons they moved away, like, you know, the voters moved away in large numbers from these family-oriented parties towards the National People's Power, which promised to eradicate nepotism and corruption.
And do you think they're going to be able to do that?
We have to wait and see. That is their main electoral promise, right? That they would fight corruption, they would fight nepotism, they would usher in a new political culture, and they have the majority, like parliamentary majority, to implement important reforms. One of the reforms that they promised was abolishing the executive presidential system and revert back to the Westminster model that existed in the country before 1977. Now, there is an opportunity for them to do that. And when powers are taken away from this monarch-like figure who is our president, there is an opportunity for democratization. Parliament will become more active, parliament will have more powers, and as a result, I think a cabinet led by a prime minister, there will be a certain kind of decentralization of powers that we will see if the executive presidency is abolished. So we have to wait and see. They have made a lot of promises, and now I think they have to deliver. And if they don't deliver, people will teach them a lesson.
It seems to me that Sri Lanka is just in a very structurally difficult position. There's no domestic industry to speak of, high foreign debts, no domestic foundation for the economy. It seems like it's just a massive structural problem that's very, very difficult to get out of. Do you think the new government has any sense of how to deal with these really long-term structural issues?
I think they are going to find it a formidable challenge. I think that's why I strongly believe that, like, you know, they have to go for measures like wealth tax, for instance. I think those are some measures that may help them find the money to introduce some social welfare programs, bring down poverty. And I also see that this is not a problem that is specific to Sri Lanka. I think there are many countries in the global south which are facing a debt crisis, and their governments are also facing a lot of opposition from the people, like countries like Kenya, for instance. I also feel that there is a need for a global alliance, or an alliance of countries from the global south to come together and demand international financial organizations like the IMF to support their countries in a different way, not like the way in which they are now, like, you know, laying down conditions and forcing them to introduce austerity measures. But they have to come together and come up with a different kind of alternative, which is a challenge, I agree. But I think that is the way forward. You have to take certain steps locally, which is very important. But at the same time, there is also a global alliance that is necessary to fight the kind of neoliberal exploitative economic system that is taking over many countries in the global south now.
That was Manhendran Turbaragon, a lecturer in English at the University of Jaffna in Sri Lanka. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with this, some of Zone from the new album Maghreb by friend of Behind the News, Birksnest. Till next week, bye.